I'm opening.
We have an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity.
Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Such a swell of music. That can only mean Clint Mansell.
Clint Mansell.
Made it. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another Anatomy of a Movie. We are discussing Darren Aronofsky's Noah, the first movie since Black Swan, the Oscar-winning Black Swan for good old Natalie Portman.
There you go. Now he's back without Natalie Portman.
Yeah, no Natalie Portman here today, but we do have Dimitri Panos back.
Well, it's great to be back. Play ball, everybody. Red Sox, opening day, Fenway Park. They're getting their World Series rings today. So exciting.
Today being April 4th, 2014. Because in a few years, it's
going to
be irrelevant.
It'll be irrelevant. And yeah, Tales from CinemaCon. I was at CinemaCon last week. Good times. Good show. Busy show. So
a lot of movies coming out. We'll be definitely talking about a lot of those movies.
Oh, my head. Yeah.
Sarah Stretton.
I am here. I did not go to CinemaCon.
Maybe fair enough. Sure. And we have Marissa Serafini in the booth today.
What's up, everyone?
And she's manning our ship, as they say. And unfortunately, no John Comfort, even though I really wanted him. You know, we would have had a kind of more or less, I can't say a fully rounded out religious panel, but, you know, somewhat.
Covering a little more of the spectrum if John was here.
Correct. Let's start with, and by the way, for those of you listening, we will certainly talk about the religious aspect of it. I just feel we're going to talk about some stuff, production and things like that, a little bit earlier on, because if we get into the religious side, we're never going to get out of it. So we're going to save that for a little bit later. But let's start with overall impressions of the movie.
Ooh, okay. So because of press and like people who saw this before me, I was not expecting a good movie. I really was going into this being like, okay, I have to sit through this. I've heard such horrible things. It's not going to be any good. And then I went in and I was very pleasantly surprised. I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I was going to. And I will watch it again. And I saw quite a few movies this week. And of the four I saw, this one has left me with the most thinking. And I think had one of the most interesting approaches to film. So I'm excited to talk about it and talk about, you know, how he filmed this and what went into it. Because I thought that it was a wonderful story.
Okay. Dimitri?
I went into this movie, I tried to go into this movie with an open mind. I know there's lots floating around about this movie controversy, which we'll talk about later. You know, when all was said and done, I came away, there was a lot to digest for me. I think it's very thought-provoking. I think it really caters to, like, you know, this is a movie to talk about. And I think it's a movie, for everybody to talk about. And I think that's what makes this movie really good. I don't find it to be, like, religious rattling. I don't think any of that stuff. I think it also showcases, this has surprised me the most, it showcases what can be very good with religion and what can be very bad with religion. That sort of kind of surprised me. And it took a lot to digest. And overall, I came away thinking, wow, I really like this movie. It's Noah's Ark. It took it away from, it was a little bit above and beyond Sunday school for me, you know, 2x2, 40 days, 40 nights, and this added to it. But I liked the overall interpretation. And I think Aronofsky did a very good job. And if you go into it with an open mind, open heart, if you're a religious person, I think you can walk away with saying, wow, let's talk about this movie in an open fashion. So,
and Marissa, you being raised religiously, what was your thoughts?
Honestly, yes, I am Catholic. And so going into this, I was expecting the very religious point of view on this movie. But knowing that Aronofsky is a self-proclaimed atheist, that I'm like, okay, he's going to take some creative artistic
license.
Yes, license to this movie. And you know what? I have to... I liked his take on it. It was dark, and it opened up a whole different point of view that I never really saw Noah in a different light in that way. So I thought that was pretty well done on his
part. For me, here's what's cool. Darren Aronofsky has been obsessed with the story of Noah's Ark since he was 13 years old. So you have that. Two, this is a story that, you know, it's not very long. So you were going to have liberties when you translate it to a 2.5-hour-ish movie.
Yeah, and the story of Noah in the Bible Genesis, it's only 5 chapters. And so, of course, the story is going to have a lot of story gaps in with it. But I liked how they filled it up throughout the movie.
And, you know, and it's Darren Aronofsky. So remember we got the follow-up to Evan Almighty.
Right.
Or it was Evan Almighty.
It was Evan Almighty.
Bruce Almighty was the first one.
Right.
Which I actually liked Evan Almighty. I thought it was a fun take on Noah, you know, and that side of it. But again, knowing Darren Aronofsky, his movies, the best way I can describe them is about a person obsessed. They just take obsession to its fullest, whether it's the wrestler and wanting to wrestle, Black Swan about wanting to do ballet.
You say obsessed, I say driven. I mean...
okay, well, but again, what that means, right? So starting with Requiem for a Dream, you know, and even Pi, you know, for many people haven't seen Pi, but Requiem for a Dream was kind of his first start. And so it's about, you can say driven, I say obsessed, not in a negative way, it's just, you know, what it can lead to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's ultimately what I love when you really dissect what good and evil is. There is no good and evil. It's just an otherwise good value taken to its extreme. So in this case, you know, as we'll talk about it, you know, the title of the movie implies everything. Noah.
Right.
And as for me, as I'm watching it, it goes to the full extent journey of Noah. And he has to take the idea of, you know, wanting to be a good human being, understanding that he's lesser than his creator, and, you know, fulfilling his task for the creator. And, you know, it almost takes him to the point where he has to kill, you know, and his not only his family, but, you know, unborn children. And so, again, that's the extreme.
Right.
Of in this case, religion and being faithful. And so I love that aspect of it. You know, in terms of the story and story technique, what did you guys like?
Go ahead.
Do you want to start? No, you can start this time.
Well, no, you know, you nailed it on the head. It's like, and this is what I really liked about the movie is that it showcased what can be all good about religion, what can be all bad. And when you talk about the fanaticism, I liked how it showed that aspect of it. And because that's, you know, when we got to that part of the movie, you know, he was Nutty Noah. And that wasn't a Noah that I had ever grown up learning about in Sunday school or whatever. And that movie got very intense. But when you break it down to today's religion, I mean, that's what we have. Like, there are suicide bombers for a reason, because they take that level. They believe in their hearts and minds that what they're doing it for a greater power. And Noah believed he was doing it for this greater power.
I'm going to get a little slack for this, but even like, you know, Nazis, you know, otherwise good value of patriotism. Taken to an extreme.
Well, yeah, and that was and Noah was taking it to an extreme. The good side is, you know, there was the love, the compassion, the redemption. One thing that I read today was that it's also about a story about survivor guilt, which I didn't think about. But when you put it into this and the way Russell Crowe portrayed Noah, yeah, there was a bit of survivalist guilt. I mean, he knew that everybody was going to get wiped off of the planet. And, you know, feeling like, why am I worthy? Why am I the one that's doing
and, you know,
this?
I mean,
and
yeah.
That's a good slant, too.
I don't know what the official definition of survivor guilt is, per se. But, like, there's one thing when you're, let's say you're on the Titanic and you happen to survive, right? That's, you know, yes, there's going to be people who interpret it in different ways. Some atheists, some religious people of like, oh, why did God choose to save me instead of these people? But at least that's kind of not necessarily your choice.
Right.
Noah knew for well that, you know, everyone but his family would be wiped off.
Right.
So that's survival guilt to the extreme.
Yeah, and that's something that he dealt with. I also appreciated the fact of you know, I like the Watchers. I liked, and again, when you go into religion, this is, the Watchers are all about redemption and trying to seek redemption. Now, again, that is nothing that I ever remembered about Sunday school. You'd heard about fallen angels, but I appreciated the fact, and I sort of kind of get why they may have been in there, because if I'm correct, Marissa, you might know more about this, but if I'm correct, it was about 120 years to make this arc, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it was a long you can't spend 120 years in a movie, so you make these Watchers, and they help with the building of the Ark, and it was really cool, and there was something that we were going to protect Noah, and I like that aspect of it as well. And, you know, like I said, I think from a filmmaking and from a writing standpoint, I thought it was very smartly written. I thought, listen, if you are religious, I mean, it refers to the Bible. I mean, it opens up with Genesis. I mean, it opens up with, on the first day, the Creator, you know, there was light. And we learn about Adam and Eve and then Cain and Abel. These are all stories that are tried and true. Everybody is mostly familiar with them. Whether you're religious or not, you've heard about them in one way, shape, or form. And this movie made those nods to that. And I think he did not shy away. Darren Aronofsky and Ari Handel did not shy away from the Bible. They used it as their blueprint, their map, so to speak. And where they took the story, I thought was fascinating and really lends to great, what we're going to have here is great conversation, because I've spoken to people who are very faith-based, and I've had intellectual, fantastic conversation with, I've had conversation with movie lovers, and I, you know, again, Noah has, this is one of the great powers of movies, when you can have fantastic conversation, and you do it with an open mind, like, this is the strength of Noah, and its filmmaking, and the writing. I think there's so many layers. It's like a nice onion. You can peel it off and you can talk about so many things. Philosophy, cinematography, editing. You can talk about it from the movie and the religious standpoint. This movie nails it.
What I like, what I like about this movie in particular from, you know, the various aspects is that it took, it, you know, he first, obviously, he, you know, he's been obsessed with the story of Noah since 13, but he really kind of started writing it at around 2007. And it was supposed to be for Brad Pitt and whatnot. But I like when things get kind of put on the shelf and then we revisit it. Mm-hmm. Inception is another one of those stories, you know, the Christopher Nolan movie. And so I like when, you know, unlike, I'm not bashing these movies, but like with Marvel now, you know, so many of these movies have to come out on certain deadlines and things like that, you know, and this movie, yes, it had to meet a certain deadline, but obviously it wasn't constrained early on by then. So he had the ability to really think about the story and write it out.
Well, I mean, he also, in a way, he had to put up his own fights with this, though, because he put it on the shelf, and but when he revisited it and brought it back to the screen, he was having to deal with screenings where production and studio heads were wanting to cut and edit, and luckily he fought so hard to get to the point that this he does feel proud of as his movie. Yeah. But this movie was very closely not what he wanted. Like, it was going through rigorous, like viewings and whatnot, and he, people wanted him to cut things out and change the whole storyline. He said, I think at this, the final version is about 98% of what he wanted.
Yeah. We should also mention, too, because I think it's very important, by the time that he had shelved it and coming back to it, a lot had changed in the Hollywood culture as well, where the faith-based movies were really gaining a lot of traction. Like, there were these small, like, Kirk Cameron kind of movies that were coming out, and they were doing, even though a very limited release, their per-screen averages are huge. For example, most recently, there's this movie, God Is Not Dead, and you know, these, the faith-based movement in cinema today is a really, it's a faction,
and
yeah,
also cinema. Like, just in TV and the shows and the History Channel and all of those have expanded and created numerous accounts, and it's really thriving.
Yeah, and it's, to an extent, it's making money. Like, they're not going, Noah right now is probably the widest, like, these are going, but the landscape changed. So I'm sure when he was first writing it and thinking about it, it was just going to be Noah. Now, you know, when he goes back to it, Paramount has to say, well, geez, do we want this kind of controversy going on? Do we want, like, you know, are we going to have a Passion on the Christ or on our hands? Or are we going to have something where people are going to be picketing? And because it you know, like I said, faith-based has become just a big market today. And, yeah, you can just look at grosses or read the box office reports that, that cinema is taking it seriously.
Yeah, you know, so when Paramount came on, you know, the budget kept changing overall, but, you know, the final budget seems to land in at $125 million. So, you know, from a studio perspective, like, Darren's never done a movie of this size. Right?
No.
Pi was $60,000. Requiem for a Dream was then, you know, and...
Right.
That's a huge step up, you know. But now you're getting to the level of Superman, Batman, those types of budgets. So yeah, you know, you're gonna have to deal with the studio, and you're gonna understand why. You know, that's a lot of money for them to put up with. And so, you know, when you reach that certain threshold, you know, the reason why Robert Rodriguez doesn't do high budget movies because he wants that freedom,
right,
of creativity.
Yeah, and you're right. It's the production budget is about 125. When you include the P&A, it's about 175. But let's take a look at a little bit at some of the grosses here. You know, the opening weekend gross, it came in at number one at the box office. Now, again, considering the controversy that's been around it, considering what Paramount has had to actually put up with, and we could talk about that in a bit, but, you know, it came in number one, so all the naysayers, so Paramount says, you know, you came in, we came in number one with $43.7 million. To date, its domestic gross is $53 million, but its total foreign and domestic is $104 million. And overseas and in places like Mexico, this movie... Mm-hmm. Because of this faith-based well, has been doing extremely well. Whether it's out of curiosity or whether it's out of, you know, people have just heard about it, or whether they actually want to see this movie and dissect it on their own, whether they love it or hate it, the movie has gained some semblance of traction globally. You know, and it's Rotten Tomatoes, because I had that up as well, was at a 76, I think, at Rotten Tomatoes, which is not bad. That means the critics, you know, it's pretty good. It's in the fresh. So, look, I think that the movie has made a groundswell for itself. It's made a name for itself. People are still talking about it, and I think they're going to continue to talk about it. One thing that was interesting when I saw it at a Sunday matinee show, 12:40. And I was amazed. Number one, the breakdown appeared to be... Latin American and African American, and there were families, and they were bringing kids. Like, if you had just walked in not knowing, like, if you just walked into the theater, you might have thought that you were seeing, like, the Muppet movie. I was amazed as to how many kids were coming in there. And then as the movie was playing out, I was like, oh, geez, do I want a kid see? I didn't expect the movie to get that intense. So the breakdown, you can tell that maybe the Sunday schools, or maybe somebody was saying, it was reaching out to an audience, and that audience seemed to come out. That theater was at least 80-85% filled on a Sunday matinee, 12:40. So after church, it looked like they were going to Noah. Interesting. How was your audience breakdown? Did anybody notice, like, anything significant?
Mine was kind of this. I actually went Sunday afternoon as well, and it was kind of similar. What I loved about this, they, you know, again, through the development of this, I mean, you know, we'll talk about the test screenings done by Paramount, but for Darren and Ari, they made a graphic novel that was in French.
Yeah.
Has anyone had gotten their hands on at least, like, images of this or whatnot?
I just read about it this morning in the conception of it, that they did the graphic novel before, like, part of it as their pitch for this film. So I
seem
not
to have worked,
seen it, but I'm sure, like, if all the detail that they put into this movie, they put into the graphic novel, I'm sure it's great. I mean, just the fact that they built this arc, an actual scale to the T, they were so detailed. And then I hope we get into the use of, like, the visuals. I have to applaud them for the textual context that they did. Mm-hmm. I think the expanses he made on the story to fill the gaps, to create character development, to add these subplots, was all fantastic. I think what really put this movie over the edge for me was the visual interpretation. I thought that he was trying new things, and I felt like I was very much in, like, in his imagination.
The landscape was so either barren or luscious,
mm-hmm. right?
Purposefully, obviously, mm-hmm. but it just it blew me away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it looked. Yeah, it really did look fantastic, you know, and. you know, regarding the graphic novel, why don't we call the graphic novel what it probably is?
Storyboards.
Like, you know, they had this idea in their head. And what's the best? Graphic novels, in a sense, are storyboards for larger stories. If, like, you can always refer to them. And they had their blueprint for how they wanted it to look, where their story could go. You know, and again, I really do find you go into this movie with an open head or an open heart, you know.
Here we have some, for those of you watching, but we'll also put the pictures up as well on the website, anatomymovie.com. But I guess this is, Marissa, this is
a translation of Darren's graphic novel, and we have some photos here.
Well, they definitely didn't mail it in. If you're watching this, it's definitely detailed.
Absolutely.
Here's another picture.
Cain and Abel. And again, storyboards. This is exactly what was in the movie. Yeah. Like, when you look at these, the way that they're parceled out. So, you know, Aronofsky himself, you know, he was, you know, talking about Noah. He was like, I think the Noah story has very much been co-opted into a parable for kids about Noah and the animals and the old man with the white beard. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, to sort of agree with that, I mean, going to Sunday school, that's what you sort of kind of learn about. 2x2, 40 days, 40 nights. This is what he did to save creatures and humanity.
And it's so fascinating, I think, for me, this story was fascinating as a child because of the animal aspect. But it was almost the religious aspect was pushed aside for me when I was getting into it. It was more about the good of saving animals versus kind of the bad of humanity or the purpose of the flood.
Sure.
And like, I was focused very much on Noah, but I thought it was always portrayed as such a almost happy occasion.
Did you watch cartoons of it? Marissa?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because...
I was going to say that because every time I was told the story of Noah or I read it in some... It's always been in, like, cartoon form, happy, bright colors and stuff. So, like, I saw it in a kid's kind of format for everyone to understand.
Okay, and growing up where, you know, I grew up in Peabody, Massachusetts, there was an Arco gas station. And they, when gas stations used to do promotions like, hey, come to us, if you fill up, we'll give you a free car. The Arco gas station, you fill up with us, we will give you, you can get an Ark, and you'll get a different animal every week to fill up your Noah's Ark. Stuff. So yeah, I mean, that was totally catering towards, you know, the families filling up their tank of gas and getting a Noah's Ark and all the animals. So, but then Aronofsky, from what we were just talking about, he goes, but if you really look at the actual story, it's not a kid's story at all. It's the first apocalypse story. And yeah, when you look at it that way, it is the first apocalypse story, and it's about the end of the world. And it's a story about destroying the thing you love most in this world. Whether it's the film's unseen creator sending a great flood to wipe out humanity, or a late film turn where Noah questions whether he and his family will even be allowed to survive, he says, it's about justice. And over the course of the film, mercy and grace are learned, and that's very much what happens to Noah in this story.
And what, you know.
And that's fantastic. But that's good. Like, you can take from that.
And, you know, I've never seen what I loved about in terms of the animals for them. You know, they had the idea of, like, you know, if one of them dies, a part of creation ends. And that blew me away. I was like, oh, I never thought of it that way.
And two animals get killed, and you know right there, you're like, I don't know what the animals were. And I think that was done on purpose. But you just know that that was the end of the line for that breed.
Yeah,
for whatever it was. And you're right.
I'd like to, you know, maybe John Logan was called in to help along with the rewrite. He's not credited in the movie. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you guys came across it in your research. Like to know, do you have any specifics that I couldn't find any of what exactly his contributions were?
I couldn't find any. In fact, I was surprised to see that his name, like, he's not on the credits, but I was surprised that he had come on in, and it didn't say specifically what he was there to punch up.
Those of you listening and you're not in Hollywood, it is sometimes, to me, they were introduced as fixers. Like, there's some people who come on board and fix things. And then, you know, sometimes that happens early on is with this guy in the script phase, or I've seen cases, I'm not going to name the movies, where, like, you know, this guy, they hire a guy, say, hey, you have a $5 million budget to make this movie watchable. And, you know, so again, I don't know his exact contributions. Knowing, I don't think there were too many.
Maybe it was to give it more of a gladiatorial kind of a, I don't know, maybe punch up Ray Winstone's character a little bit. I honestly
don't know. Knowing how Darren writes, I think, you know, one, that was the other part for me is I loved, you know, Noah had an equal. And the way he was fleshed out, and he ended up, because, you know, he could have very well been flooded, but he found his way onto the boat, or the Ark. And that became a storyline. And so I'd never seen that. So I credit, you know, I wonder where all of these little things came into, you know, but I'd be real interested to learn what his full contribution was. And especially, yeah. You know, if Sarah's saying that, you know, Darren is happy with the move to a 98% level, then.
What's the 2%?
Then, yeah, what is the 2% that he's unhappy with?
I mean, those are questions that you'd have to ask probably him, because he's the only one who can answer. And it's just, but what does work and what you have to apply to, because if there were, I guess, man, three people working on the script, how they did intersect all of these storylines to fit Noah, whether it be the inclusion of his, you know, the rival, the men, or if you're bringing in the story, subplot of them finding wives. All of these little details, they tied in together very well. And it made sense. And I felt like when Ham conceals him in the boat, it all felt supported. So it didn't feel like someone was just adding in these little tidbits to make it work. I felt like everything was still connected.
Yeah.
Nothing felt too forced to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to find, like, I'm looking up an article that was on comingsoon.net about John Logan on Noah and Skyfall. But again, when you look at some of the movies that he's done, like The Aviator, mm-hmm. The Last Samurai, Gladiator, I also believe he wrote a Star Trek movie, Nemesis.
Mm-hmm. He also wrote Ranga.
he writes very epic ish kind of storylines, and so he might have just been in to punch up certain things, like, I don't know.
I mean, the battle before the flooding.
Also, if you have this, you have someone who's been so connected to a story for years, sometimes you just want that outside opinion. Because if you get too, you can get so focused on like the little details and have it so set in your ways because you've lived with it for so long. Yeah. I think sometimes it's nice to have someone else come in, especially like if you respect them or they have, you know, experience with big epic movies. As you said, he's done much smaller budgets, like, to make sure that you're kind of going the right direction. I mean, the studios have a lot of money at stake. They want to make sure.
Yeah, and here's some, I mean, this doesn't pinpoint exactly where we're going, but it goes, while Logan tends to be a writer involved in a project from beginning to end, his work with Aronofsky isn't quite as immersive. And Logan goes on to say, I just dipped in to help a little because I've liked Darren's work and we just sort of talked about it and it was fun. It was really great. This coming again from John Logan. I think Darren is an auteur and I think he's a genuine artist. He responded when asked whether this would be Aronofsky's return to larger scale films like The Fountain. And he goes on to say, I think any movie is going to be his sensibility. What excites me about is the revisionist idea Darren Aronofsky is doing to a Bible movie. Mm-hmm. It's like when Ridley Scott came to me with Gladiator. I was like, you're out of your mind. It's a sword and sandal movie, but we were able to sort of put new gloss on an old genre. There couldn't be more of an old tired genre that we think of a biblical epic. You have those images of Cecil B. DeMille and Charlton Heston. So, it looks like he was just brought in to maybe punch up some of those certain aspects that we were talking about already. And John Logan doesn't seem like he was there for a long time. He seemed to almost do it as a favor. And it's like, hey, I like the...
Yeah, as a friend.
Yeah. And so, again, those little collaborative things in Hollywood, you sort of kind of like it. And he says, yeah, we sat down, we had a good time.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly showed what I loved, you know, before we kind of move into the actors. And I want to talk about more of this in the cinematography. But what I love about Darren is that, you know, it's one thing to write a script, but it's also another thing to be the writer and then direct it, because Darren is so visual.
I feel like when you have this movie, though, Darren, in a way, has to direct it, because I feel like through the writing, so much of this is about the imagery and the imagination and the detail and the color.
I mean, remember the, because again, you know, on a script, it could be like, okay, and the water flows outward. right. creating trees, right? Or creating mm-hmm. life, whatever you want to call it. And that right. would be the script line. But in there, you have, you know, in the let's say 8 seconds, you have like 3 trillion images of yeah. this one river just forming branching everything.
Out. Yep, yep. Mm-hmm.
You know?
And I wonder if that was in the comic. Because again, it looked like they were doing a storyboard, and I would have liked to have seen how that could be. But yeah, you're right. And visually, he brings something to it too that we haven't quite seen before.
Well, visually, kind of it doesn't really feel like he doesn't stick to a visual genre. Like, you have these instances of very just like realistic, stark landscape, and then all of a sudden you're in almost like a sci-fi fantasy, and then you're in like National Geographic with time lapses and whatnot, and evolution happening from single frames. And like, he doesn't confine himself to being like, this movie has to be
no
one way. He takes on all these different types of vision, and I think that's what's
let me so ask engaging. You this let's hold off on the actors
okay.
since we're getting into this, and I want to ask each of you, including you, Marissa. You know, for me, what I love about his movies, they have been always so visual, but they've been based in the real.
Sure.
And, like, for example, the flower coming out, or when his tears drop and the flower's forming throughout the movie.
Right.
It's borrowed from the fountain. He's done this in the fountain, mm-hmm. and but it's a real way of shooting an actual flower growing, and you reverse it, and it's a long, long process.
Sure.
Doesn't take yeah. a day, not even 2 days. It takes like months, if not, you know, almost a year. And in this movie, for me, visually, portions, I loved them, but then there was some, I knew there was visual effects. And it kind of bummed me out because I'm so used to, especially in The Fountain, where things just feel so real. Go ahead, Marissa.
Well, I was going to say, I think they used that aspect, how they simultaneously showed evolution, but creationism, and because to kind of cater to both audiences. Because in, you know, the story of the Bible, that God created the whole land and life and all that within 7 days. And here on Earth, we know that things have to take time to evolve. So I liked how he showed both versions of that. And so we saw the evolution of the stream and things growing. And so we got that. And then we had the flower, which was created in a second. So we got both different versions.
Yeah, for me, it was like the Genesis effect. Yeah. Which literally and figuratively, but he did a...
To me, it was like a bridge.
Yeah.
It was like he was trying to kind of bridge things. And like, I do like that he had like the instantaneous and the movement, but as well, when he was talking about how it was in 7 days, but visually showing so much growth, right. It made me rethink just like the meaning of time. And like the... like. If there was no man and we had time, like, how is this interpreted? The time of light, the time of growth. Like, I just thought it was a very interesting way to kind of find a solution and to use, like, your imagination to bond, I guess, in a way, religious philosophy and science. And then as well as being very visually stunning. And so I thought that was beautiful art. There were certain things, because he was using so many effects throughout the entire film.
Well, the movie opened up with... Well, the movie opened up with like a stylized visual effect
mm-hmm.
that, you know, of the watchers and things like that, you know that I mean. Then transitioned into a more realistic sense. And right. kind of threw me off initially.
Yeah. And, I will give it to him because, you know, you're right. Mm-hmm. There were some parts, you know, that felt CG-ish or, you know, special effect-ish, let's say. But considering this is probably his biggest movie and maybe not a realm of maybe a comfort level. I'm not saying that it makes him any less of a professional director. I'm just saying, you know, when you have a $125 million budget, he's cramming a lot in there. And so, you know, I'm going to give it to him because I think ultimately, you know, this wasn't 300, Rise of an Empire or whatnot, but you know, knowing that there wasn't any real, I mean, they can literally say no animals were harmed because there were no animals there, that there was nothing. They were all CG.
Weren't there two doves? Am I mistaken on that?
From what
maybe in the flight.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, cause remember they sent out the birds right. to check on land.
They sent a raven the first time to check the air, if there was any like life in the sky atmosphere. Land, right? And then they sent the dove to check the ground. Two different types of birds.
So I could I could see those as being real because they're not interacting with the humans as much.
But of all the ARC animals and all of that going on, everything was CGI. And they were all slightly altered.
Well, they were modified.
They modified animals.
And again, like the two animals that get killed, they weren't any necessarily animals that I would... you would sort of recognize it as something, but I couldn't put a name to it. It was just... You know, it was just very fascinating. I also like the line about snakes, too, you know, coming in. But, you know, the birds flying looked a little bit CG-ish. But, you know, all in all, I'm like, everything else is working. That is such a minor thing. Like, it didn't take me out of the movie.
It didn't take me out. What it is, if nothing else, a testament to he's done so many. Again, the fact that you could shoot. And, you know, you're not shooting film, you know. Yes, film is moving images, but when you, when you shoot an image like once every 3 hours or whatever, I don't consider that filming. So to go through that pain, that's like stop motion.
Yeah.
To go through that painstaking process, again, this is borrowing from the fountain, but, you know, the technique is reused of a flower growing and then reversing it and things like that. That to me is amazing. And so I hold him to such a high standard. I'm like, oh. You had to go to some of the visual effects. The animals, I understand, but some of the stuff I wanted to be like, okay, Darren, how are you going to pull this off in real life?
Yeah, and but he always has, you know, the other thing, too, it's a personal story, too. When you look at his movies, they're always a personal story. And Noah, he made this a personal story. And I think because this is a different Noah and, you know, he always will focus on the personal side. So, again, there was nothing in the movie that I had to be taken out. I guess I forgave it. Yeah. If the movie were bad, if this movie were a bad movie, then you're like going, it looked cheap. It didn't. But for the most part, it didn't look cheap at all.
And
at
I think
all.
That what it is he puts so much out there that – and there's so much – like with different shots and different techniques, he probably put – I don't know. You have underwater. You have land. You have rock – fallen angels, you have time lapses, you have the silhouette of the black with the colors going on, you have different silhouettes in sequence doing the same action. You're using all of these different techniques. The chances are that people aren't going to like every single one of them. And it's the people who come out of the movie clinging to that one component that they didn't like. I'm like, it was 2 seconds and you liked everything else that was done well, but you're going to throw a fit about the 2 seconds because he tried a technique that didn't sit well with you. That, to me, it's just not being fair. It's not looking at...
I know, I'm not being fair.
I think you're being fair.
Here's what I will say. Here's what I say. It started, you know, and again, this is such a nitpick on my part. It started being, to me, what I liked about it, you know, when we, once the forest bloomed and we brought in humans, because for the most part, early on, you're just interacting with, you know, either mainly him or the family at best. And so once they brought in everybody else, I was like, okay, now I see people. It opened up the world for me, and that's when I settled in. But again, I loved it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that you shouldn't nitpick or have opinions. I think that when art is created, it's meant to have a reaction, opinions. I'm saying to look at the beauty in it and not pick out the one single flaw and have that be your overall, like, emotion.
I'm ignorant,
notice it.
No,
there are things I didn't like specifically. Like, I was like, at the end when they rebrought in the animals and it was slower and it was just the focus, like on the monkeys and the bears for reproduction. That wasn't my favorite part, but I still liked the movie and I didn't come out of the movie being like, well, this one thing was horrible, so the whole movie's horrible.
Well,
still notice, still have an opinion. It's art, you're allowed to.
Yeah, and you know, Matthew Libatique, I don't know if I butchered his last name, he's the cinematographer in this movie, and this guy has run the gambit. He's done everything from Justin Timberlake videos to Ruby Sparks to Cowboys and Aliens to Black Swan to Noah. So this guy has The Miracle of St. Anna. This guy has worked from big to small. He did Iron Man. So, you know, and in this movie, this has it all. I mean, big to small to in camera to out of camera effects to CG. You know, the guy did a really good job. And then when you're using a lot of CG, like with the water effects and the flood and all this, and, you know, it became a tense movie. It became an intense movie at times. And part of it, I think, was just visually. I thought it told its story. It was paced very well. and it told its story, and they really tried to bring in a lot of what I really appreciate about the movie is that they didn't come out and say, your beliefs are horrible, this is going to be this, and they really, I thought, for me, I felt that they took care to try to include, even though they went off the pages, they tried to include things that said, hey, guys, we are using the Bible. Regardless of how you read the Bible, we're using it as our blueprint. And they did it from a visual act style. They did it from a narrative style. And that, to me, is that's a win. Because, you know, you can point at it, and I guess you can hate it if you want to. But I was more impressed with the fact that what they crammed in there. And again, like the whole, like people were upset, they don't use God, they don't name God. And I'm like, well, as soon as you say God, boom, it becomes a particular religion. And right there, it sets it up. But by calling it the creator, it makes it a little more secular. It makes it acceptable for anybody who knows.
That's the funny
stories.
Part to me. It's written by an atheist.
But you know what? Again,
you know, that you can find spirituality. You can find, again, I think for me, you can find the fact that all of this can exist, and, you know, through, you know, to me, that's just beautiful enough.
Mm-hmm. But you know what? I didn't mind the atheism in this because it brings a whole new perspective to a story that's been around forever. And I liked how he took that new vision and displayed it for everyone to see.
Mm-hmm. I'll take it one step further. I mean, I understand that the people are upset with that. My whole thing is, who cares? He came out to tell a story. He felt that this was a great story. He was obsessed with it at 13, and he felt, wow, this is a really great survivalistic story. It has all these elements in it. And a good storyteller, regardless of his religious belief and or background, so long as he was putting together a good story that I don't think disrespected anybody, including himself. I think he put up on screen pretty much what he wanted to say. And, you know, you can find things.
Let's talk
about it.
Let's talk about this, because
it's senseless.
You know, we could talk about Noah and his entire, you know, and we kind of will about it, but it's about Noah, right? And he mm-hmm. represents something. But, you know, from the beginning and then midpoint, we get the villain again. And the villain is equally as obsessed as Noah
mm-hmm.
in a different way, to the extreme. And that's what I think about it, you know, really full circle. All right? And we got the full spectrum, because you have his family kind of layered somewhere in the middle. And then you have, he was amazing. You know, what was his line about, you know, basically.
Are you talking about Tubal Cain?
Yes.
Okay. Which, and
his belief, I forget the line exactly, but he had the belief of, you know, because I am made in God, in the creator's image,
this is the world.
This, yeah, all everything
right.
is mine.
We're a man, right.
And meat gives us strength.
Well, it goes down to, I think, the one of the themes throughout this was what is rules man, and whether it's dominion, or I believe he called it dominion or stewardship, was something that Darren kind of labeled one of the themes as. And I think that they both represent a side of that coin. And you're right that they both have these desires and rationalizations for what they deserve and who they should be. And then in between, you've kind of got the stepping ladder of each family member having their different perspective. And, you know, you can't tell him that he's inaccurate, because it's pointed so much at a lot of people's philosophy today.
Right.
And how we look at it. And that's why a lot of stuff's coming out about this being about environmentalism, or about being vegetarian, or being like all right. over the board, because people are putting.
Well, it's not saying Noah's good either. Like, Noah went the other extreme.
Oh, yeah. I called him Nutty Noah. I mean, he went off the rails, this guy. And that surprised me. Because, again, growing up, we were talking about it. You never see Noah like. I would never think that Noah would put a knife to a baby's skull. Like, I guess, that part,
okay.
like,
yeah.
was
ahead,
very
that did not surprise me, because
I saw it as Noah was the overly righteous man, and Tubal Cain was the very corrupt man. And Noah's dedication. I wouldn't say motivation or crazy nuttiness. I would say Noah is a very dedicated, righteous man, and he's dedicated his whole life to obeying the Creator's demands and stuff. So I saw Noah going to that extreme just to show how dedicated he is. And then Cain just being showing the evil and corruptness of the world, that this is why the Creator wants to wipe everyone out, because it's
Hold on.
Cain.
You have to look at, okay, you're labeling him as evil, because here's the thing. What I liked about it
I'm saying he's corrupt.
Okay.
Tubal Cain is corrupt.
But you have to look at it from his perspective of the Creator left us. And look at what it is he's left us, and he's left us with nothing. And you know what? We're now left to fend on our own. And again, so he's coming, whether you believe it or not, he's coming from an okay place.
Yeah.
Again, just taken to an extreme.
Well, he's coming from a place where it's every man for himself, in a sense. Like, we have to fend for ourselves. We've tried reaching out. He made us in his image, but he doesn't talk to us.
How many times did Noah reach out to the Creator of, like, why don't you answer me? And you don't, I'm sure.
The thing about, I think that this encounters, and this is definitely getting the religious thing, is the concept of faith and being able to persevere without that communication back. And that's touched on in three levels in this. And I was not surprised by the dagger to the baby's skull by Noah, because things of that drastic nature happen other times in the Bible where people are told that they must be willing. They don't always have to do it, but they must be willing to break these like boundaries, whether it's, you know,
kind of. I don't think God, again, if you want to break this down, God gave him the vision that the earth was going to be wiped out. God never gave him the vision that to kill babies.
Okay,
he never gave him that vision, so he took it to a level.
Another instance of the Bible, I can't remember which chapter it's in, where there's a father who's told, I believe, kill all, Mercy, you can correct me if I'm wrong, all of his sheep, and eventually is told that he must kill his son, and he's about to do it, and then God stops him.
God stopped him. Like, in this movie, Noah made the choice not to. So, again, it's one of those, his fanaticism, his beliefs took him to such an extreme where, in his mind, he felt he was being righteous, but he wasn't being righteous. And Emma Watson's character said it, like, listen, God gave you the choice, and this was a test, and you made the choice of love and compassion and redemption. Like, there's no reason why, like, you shouldn't feel good about that. And that, to me, is the side that's where religion can be good.
Yes.
And, you know, but there was never any sense that God told him, kill babies.
No, I agree.
That's what he believed in his head.
There was the untold version of just saying, Noah believed that these babies that were about to be born, they're going to become corrupt people too. So you have to start cold turkey, even if that means killing the babies.
Yeah, but your key word was belief. Oh, well, they're two turkeys.
Well, I was more actually talking about faith. If you can see similarities between, like, the Watchers and the instances of Cain, because the Watchers lose their faith and almost become like these dark figures, and you almost see them kill Noah at the beginning until one remembers that there is a faith there, and eventually they get called back up. And it's because they're doing a selfless act without the idea that they are going to be rewarded and standing up for the good, and they've lashed through and come back to their faith so they can come back home.
Right.
And like with Cain, he has been demanding, or he feels like the children of Cain feel like they've been left alone, therefore they're entitled to the world, because they've turned all back on faith and are unwilling to accept that, like, they're not patient enough to wait for a calling. They just have been too corrupt. So you're saying that they have rationalizations and reasons and they feel this way, but it's not just that. It's not that they're, I think it is accurate for Mercer to say they're in a vein evil or corrupt. It's not just a way of thinking. Does that make sense?
I don't think you're entirely right. I mean, because, you know, again, you have to, in, here's part of, you know, and if you really want to break it down, there's a default way of thinking, right? And I think part of the whole movie is to make you think about religion, and you know, you can be religious. That's not, but understand why you believe in something, why you don't. And, you know, too many people just go about their day in what I call the natural default human setting. Mm-hmm. And they don't think about things. You know, you're at a grocery line, and your natural inclination is to be upset and angry. Why? Because there's no experience you've ever had in your life that doesn't support the idea that you are the center of the universe.
Okay.
Right? Tell me I'm wrong.
Well,
there are plenty of lines that I were the center of the universe,
but no.
But you understand that, and you're totally like, why is this line got to be so long? I got stuff to do. But again, you know, but now,
why am I stuck in traffic when thousands of other people are in the same position that I'm in? But we always internalize and goes, oh,
exactly. Well, and the point being, in this case, you have people who have made two very specific choices, and you know, the family as well. They're kind of, you know, being tested throughout, and they're picking their positions. But in the case of these two men, they've made their choice, and you have to, again, for better or worse, understand why they've made the choices that they've made. And ultimately, I don't know if you can really pinpoint and say one's bad, one's not.
I think it was made to essence what Marissa and Sarah, what you were saying. I think that it was made that Tubal Cain was the, let's quote-unquote, villain. You know, he comes from that Cain, from that corruptness of killing his brother. I mean, that is something that was in the bloodline. You certainly, as a villain, if we'll call him a villain just for the sake of this conversation, if there's a better word, somebody give it to me. But
person,
all right, as a foil, okay. As a foil, you know, you understand his motivation. You understand, like, well, we've been trying to, you know, he made us in his image, so that must mean that we're God of this planet. He gave us this planet for a reason. And again, although, albeit it could be misguided vision, I mean, where Noah is saying, well, look what it's brought you. It has brought you nothing but chaos. Everybody's fighting for themselves. You've brought disease upon yourself. And look at, you call this a life? And I think with Noah, who's the exact opposite, and almost goes to that extremist fashion. Again, he almost goes to suicide bombing. Like, we know, like, if in this movie he had killed the babies, I think everybody would have turned on this movie. Like, that is, we know that killing babies would not have been the route to go. And again, I'm going to say that this wasn't anything that I learned about in Sunday school. I never knew this. I liked the aspect, and it gave Noah the opportunity to really think hard and use his faith and open his heart and the love and compassion. Nice.
Well, this plot of the babies was created for this film. And I think that it did do a great job illustrating that internal dilemma and his choice.
Mm-hmm.
Where that said, is that the misguided vision, I think that there is an internal right and wrong in a way. I think that when you have a villain that I'm going to label as a villain, coming to the conclusion where he could be saved because he's on a boat, and then continuing to want to murder, and then say he's going to pillage not only the whole boat, but their women and their sons, like, that makes you a villain.
Yeah.
There is an intrinsic right and wrong where I think that, you know, you have to kind of respect other people's freedom and right to, I don't know.
Hey, I'm not saying he's the nicest guy. I'm just saying you can justify anything. What I liked about the choice was it didn't just end him pulling away the knife and giving the kiss. It afterwards, like, I really messed up.
Yes.
I am not worthy. I messed up. I must go in seclusion. Yeah. And, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't until they finally, Emma Watson and him had the talk.
Yeah.
I was like, you know what? Oh, okay.
And again, I will say, too, to Darren Aronofsky's credit, you know, the conversation, and I think to Darren Aronofsky and the talent involved, like Emma Watson, I thought she delivered those lines. She was, because any other time it could have just come off as blah exposition or sappiness, but it worked.
And because it's exposition as ammunition.
Yeah, but depending on how it was delivered too, you could have thought it's sappy, but she really delivered it home, and it made, boom, it was like the light dawns. And you go, that's great. And when Noah comes back and he's with Jennifer Connelly, he's with his wife, and they sort of touch their hands. It was a really touching scene. I thought it was very nicely done.
For me, it was up until that point, he was unwilling to listen to anybody else. Right. And this was the first time that he listened to somebody else about, you know, what religion, the creator, whatever you want to say, and was able to change his perspective. Up until that point, he believed what he believed, and, you know.
And everybody else believed it with him up to a point. Like, he was the only one. Like, his wife was like, you can't kill the baby. And his son, for sure, didn't want to allow him. And Emma Watson, for sure, you know, she may have said, sure, I'll give it, you know, gladly sacrifice. But you knew that deep inside that that was not the case. And, you know, up to a point, everybody else was following him, too, because he's like, hey, listen, I had a vision. We're going to get flooded. We have to build an ark. And the wife was like, okay, I support you. I believe in this. And I think that's a good thing, you know, it gives a good perspective.
Let's talk about this because, you know, we've been talking about Noah, Noah, Noah. But ultimately, Russell Crowe is Noah. But how did you guys feel, you know, some of the other people considered was Christian Bale, Michael Fassbender. Ironically enough, Christian Bale is in Ridley Scott's Exodus coming out later this year. You know, how did you guys feel about Russell's performance? Obviously, we've been raving about it. And then do you feel that, you know, these other actors could have delivered? And if so, how would it be different, the same?
When I heard, like, the list of the people who were also put up for this, like, I love Michael Fassbender, and I was like, oh, he would have done a great job, too. But, like, I feel like Russell Crowe did a wonderful job with this role. I was a huge Gladiator fan, so seeing him back, I felt like this brought him back to a, I guess, the level that his name deserves. I saw Les Mis. I wasn't too happy with it there. Maybe it was, you know, I was maybe a little bit one of the naysayers of that performance. But he, I felt very connected to it. I saw the internal struggle. I saw the dedication. I felt like there were so many levels going on with him. I think that his relationships felt very fleshed out. I think that on part was also just because they all felt very grounded in their family as a unit.
Mm-hmm.
It was very believable that they were supportive of each other and that they were kind of on their own little island fighting the world. And that's very much to do with the acting. And I think that it comes back to how they made this film. So much of it is CGI and visual, and they had to ground their acting just in each other, just in those relationships, or the movie would not have worked.
Yeah.
And that's all, I think, credit to directing and acting. And
I think, you know, there's obviously going to be a lot of people for Noah, but then for Tubal Cain, Liam Neeson.
Mm-hmm. You could very much see.
Val Kilmer were considered.
Mm-hmm.
Darren was looking for an actor with the grit and size to be convincing as he goes head to head against Crow's Noah character.
Yeah.
And they matched that pretty well.
Yeah, I think so too. And, you know, Michael Fassbender would have given an interesting slant to it. Christian Bale, I think, would have been great. My only thing is, I think Russell Crowe, from an age perspective, filled it out, because years go on. Go by, and, you know, we can see Russell Crowe is aging, but he sort of kind of fits that mold. And he didn't. The one thing, too, that I don't think any of the other actors would have done either, but, you know, there is that sense, because when we think of religious epics, we do think back to, like, the Ten Commandments, and there could have been the overacting, but Russell Crowe brought to it an internal piece. Like, he was understated at times, and, you know, I thought he did a very good job. I think they matched up great.
And the interesting component that he really added for me was that often, so much in religious films, the male has, like, more of a humility that's almost like he's, like, very graceful. For Russell Crowe, he added that warrior edge to Noah, and I think that is why they had to bring in someone who could, you know, face off against that, because from now, as an audience, what we know of Russell Crowe is we know he's not going to back down, and we know that he can, you know, handle most people. So I liked that level of like soldier that he could bring to it and stand up for and like fight for the arc and fight for his cause. And I felt that like physically he could handle that. Mm-hmm. And I liked that aspect. It wasn't someone who was just, you know, hiding behind their arc or like taking a step back and letting the creator protect them. It was very much he had this battle to face to prove that humanity on some level should survive. And I liked that they gave him that, not brutal edge, but masculine.
Well, he had a belief, you know, and he was, you know, but again, he didn't overplay the part, so to speak. He didn't go overboard. He, you know, he played it to such an extent where I really felt that there were some parts where he was understated. Like, he played it simple and quiet, and then he had to take charge of situations. Mm-hmm. And I really do think that ultimately, very fine actors, Fassbender and Christian Bale, but ultimately, you know, casting did their job, and they came to Russell Crowe, and I think he delivered a really good performance, one of his finest in a while. I wasn't one of the naysayers against Les Mis. I thought, geez, I thought he was getting really pummeled undeservedly. I thought he was okay. You know, he was Jor-El in Man of Steel, and and he played that in a sense very understated as well. But this one, there are lots of levels. Again, when that person, he had a character arc, and he plays the character arc, I thought he did very well, because he goes from a person of belief, and you can tell that he loved his family, as you said, and that was a component. And then he went from that belief to like he grew into that fanaticism where nobody was going to sway him. And he was like, nope, this is the right thing. And he went, like I called him Nutty Noah. But then when the compassion and when he realizes, he brings it back in again, and you find the sympathy. And when he was secluded from his family and he has the conversation with Emma Watson and he goes back to his family, those emotions in his, like, he did a very good job. And he did have he had an arc. No pun intended.
I agree. I think Russell Crowe did a great job, because they showed in this movie Noah has a lot more layers and a lot of internal conflict that I thought really related to just the normal human being, those humanistic qualities that brings it more realistic to today's society. And I think because in the story of Bible, yes, it is really short, and it seems, from when I read it all the time, that it seems like Noah is a very yes man kind of person and just does whatever God or the creator wants him to do, and he just does it. And in this movie, he does do all those things that the creator asked for, but then he also questions it. And I think they really touched upon that that quality in a person as well, and I thought Russell Crowe did a great job showing that.
And some of the other actors, just to read them off real fast, and then we can discuss Jennifer Connelly, his wife, obviously. Ray Winstone, cast as Tubal Cain. Emma Watson. Yeah, they were going to go with Dakota Fanning, but Emma got in there. Logan Lerman as Ham. Anthony Hopkins. What a performance.
Yeah.
We also had Nick Nolte as the leader of the Watchers. I found that interesting.
Nick Nolte.
I think that it's so funny to me. Anthony Hopkins always. I typically walk away from an Anthony Hopkins movie just being like, Anthony Hopkins. That's all I can think about. And that's not to say that he didn't do a fantastic job in this movie, because he did. He just has such a way of making everything simultaneously serious and funny, particularly with his berries in this film. But I walked away not overwhelmed by Anthony Hopkins, which is interesting to me, is just a testament to the other actors that they kind of reached his level. Is I left really thinking about all of them, not just Russell Crowe, but thinking that they just held together as a unit. I just thought that none of them really stood out for me. And I think that's how it's supposed to be.
You know, obviously Emma's Emma, but you know, the rest of you have to have the kids kind of be able to hold their own, and those three actors were phenomenal.
Yeah, and you know, I'll go back to Anthony Hopkins. I mean, just recently, I mean, you know, he's had a modicum of success with Thor, you know, as Methuselah. I thought I thought he was really good. And I thought he brought the grandfatherly aspect of that character that also had the mysticism and the magic. Exactly. But, you know, I mean, let's face it, though. There have been some other roles where Anthony Hopkins, like the Wolfman, Slipstream, you know, this guy has sort of kind of phoned in some, you know, this guy has sort of kind of phoned in some performances. So you sometimes you just don't know what you're going to get. I think with him, but this one, like, I bought him as the grandfatherly mm-hmm. type, and you know the whole thing with the berries, you know, I like, but he seemed like he would be a fun grandfather, mm-hmm. you know, unless, hey, it's time for you to go to sleep, mm-hmm. you know, go out. But yeah, I mean, but to your point, Anthony Hopkins' role too, his screen time was what, 10-15 minutes? I mean, I don't even think it's a right. I mean, it wasn't in it for a long time. I think they were very, you know, Russell Crowe, Jennifer Connelly, Emma Watson, you know, the sons, they were fine. But the three people really stood up, and they each represented, like, they were a good rounded out cast, mm-hmm. I felt, and good stuff.
I agree, because Russell Crowe and Jennifer Connelly, they were together, and of course Beautiful Minds, and then Logan Lerman and Emma Watson were together in Perks of Being a Wildflower. So I definitely got that familiarity between everyone who's worked with each other, but I thought it was an overall well-balanced family cast ensemble.
Yeah, they all worked. And even too, with Ray Winstone coming in as Tubal Cain, I thought, you know, again, he was he played a good foil.
He did.
Yeah.
Certainly did. Let's talk about the music. You know, we talk. How many movies do we do about Hans Zimmer?
Well,
goodness.
He's like, yeah, he's the go-to guy.
He's the go-to. But Clint Mansell's made a name for himself. I mean, how many times has the Requiem for a Dream song been used in trailers, right?
Oh, all the time.
Many times.
Oh, a ton.
Which was also a Darren Aronofsky film.
Sure.
Well, that's, mm-hmm. again, they haven't not done a movie together.
Yeah. One of my favorite Clint Mansell's is Moon.
Yeah.
Moon is a great,
that's a movie
great
that
soundtrack.
Clint did without Darren, you know. Yeah. But it to me, it's just similar because it's about, like, a man, not obsessed, but, you know, it's a man on his own.
Finding himself.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, the music was so instrumental in making this an epic movie.
Yeah.
And it had Clint's stamp on it. I mean, uh-huh. The Fountain has such a distinct, he has his own distinct voice. The Fountain, Requiem for a Dream, Pie, all these things.
How would you describe his voice?
Clint Mansell?
Mm-hmm.
And very much in keeping with, just about a person obsessed, and I don't know. I don't know how to describe it, but it's so. Here's the right. Requiem for a Dream was not meant to be an epic movie, but it had such an epic score.
But Pi too. If you listen to the Pi soundtrack, it's more. It's almost electronic.
Yeah.
And he did that, and then you know you. If you listen to Pi and you listen to this score, you didn't know the Wiser, you wouldn't know it was the same guy who composed it.
Absolutely not.
I think what's interesting, like if you listen to it right now, it's just like. For me, he masters the build. And he adds, like, for this, like, you can hear, like, almost the angelic voice. There's the triumph. But then, almost, I felt throughout the movie, I kept noticing, I felt like it was just breath. Like, breath of life into the film. And I don't know how, it's a beautiful capturing of sound.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it fits, too. I mean, this is a biblical, this is an epic biblical movie. Mm-hmm. You know, the lights that, I can't recall that we've seen, like, you know, you can say Evan Almighty, but that's
a comedy.
For comedic effect. Yeah. I'm trying to think of the last biblical epic movie that we've seen. Like, you know, a lot of these faith-based that we were talking about earlier, they're small pictures.
Like Passion of the Christ?
Yeah, that could have been, like, the last one. And Passion of the Christ was based on, you know, Mel Gibson did what he did with that movie. But again, when you're going to talk about biblical, it being epic, it didn't have, like, Passion of the Christ became Passion of the Christ. I mean, this was a small studio who released that movie. It didn't have, like, huge, huge backing that Noah had at the time. And Passion of the Christ, just like, that was a lightning in a bottle for them. And that was epic. It was really big. It was violent, you know. showed this, but yeah, I would say I would go as far back as Passion of the Christ. This one has a more, I would say, more commercial sensibility than, say, Passion.
I would agree.
You know, this one had a
also
very...
Also how it's just been kind of presented
right.
in the media.
And it's apocalyptic. It's world-ending.
And Emma Watson said, I mean, this could take... It could take place any time.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's what makes it identifiable to the viewers of like, okay, you know, we're getting to a time when, again, things are also so shaky. That's a pun here in Hollywood because we've had right. recent earthquakes and whatnot. But yeah, you know, you kind of wonder of like, what does this all mean?
Yeah.
You know, and is an end coming in some sort of way and whatnot? I don't know.
Yeah.
People are asking that.
Didn't you see Always. This is the end?
This is the end. Yeah, I did. Yeah. There's been a lot of those movies. This is the end.
The world's end.
The world's end. Two of our favorites.
Day After Tomorrow.
So let's talk about, now we can get into the religious side a little bit more, a little bit thicker. Because, you know, Paramount, they screened it with religious, usually a test screening. You want to test it out. I don't know, Dimitri, you can speak more of this perhaps, sure. but you would want to screen it more broader, test screen it. They screened it with religious
audiences. Well, yeah, I mean, again, you know, to Paramount's, look, Paramount sees that way. We were talking about it. They know that the faith-based audience can reach out and they'll get their people to go to the movies. You know, the interesting thing about Noah for me was like watching it up to prior to its release is the amount of deflection Paramount had to do. I would say about a month or so before the movie came out. It was in the trades and whatnot. There was a report that said something to the effect of a survey done where 80% of the people seeing, you know, God's Not Dead or Son of God, whatever that movie is, forget the title, are not going to see Noah. And all of a sudden, like, Paramount's like, what report? Like, what are you talking about? And they had to go out.
I think it was The Hollywood Reporter.
I'm sorry?
The Hollywood Reporter did that.
No, they ran the story. They didn't do the it came up to be almost like this sham, like they created this report and Paramount comes out and says, what are you talking about? Because then they had to go and do a report and said, you know what? We actually did it with a legitimate survey source and the people are saying that they are going to go see Noah. So instantly they're on the defensive. Then comes like 2 weeks or a week before the movie's release, headline comes up out of nowhere that says Pope denies meeting with filmmakers of Noah or cancels meeting with filmmakers of Noah. And Paramount's like, when did that happen? It's like, no, he's allowing them to talk to. It's like they were always somebody was always out there
trying to debunk. All
yeah.
Like,
and debunk this movie.
And then it's just been like countries are prohibiting it, and it's just been a lot of like negative targeted press, which is why I went to this movie being like, I don't think it's going to be any good. And then I went, I was like, I don't understand it. I understand that people want to create controversy, but it's a good movie.
Yeah, and like, again, when you look at Rotten Tomatoes, it's 76%. So that, you know, that's a pretty decent rating. That means a majority of the critics like the movie for whatever, you know, for whatever their reasons being. And, you know, now there was an article that came out about it was about more or less the cinema score. Yeah. Now it said it got a cinema score of a C. And if I was trying to bring up that article, oh, here we go. Noah is a hit, yet film fans may not believe in it. And it's talking about how it comes out, it does number one at the box office, but yet it gets this cinema score of a C, which for movie terms is not good. That means word of mouth, people aren't liking it. And, you know, so yet again, Paramount has to come out there and say, guys, this is, I'm just trying to find the quote. Oh, the one thing cinema score doesn't pick up well is when feelings are passionate on either side. And to in a sense is right. I don't know if you've ever been to a movie on a Friday night, but sometimes you get
the
Yeah, the little thing, you got to tear it away. It's like a Chad, almost. It's like a vote, and you vote A, B, C, or D, or F. And that's what CinemaScore is. And, you know, I don't know. I haven't spoken to anybody who's disliked the movie. We seem to collectively have appreciated the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, there was reports, February 17th, there was a report that 98% of members of the faith-driven consumer, a Christian church organization, were not satisfied with the movie. Those people did not see the movie yet.
Yeah. So, again.
It's very sad. I feel bad for like the filmmakers who tried to put this to film, and for all the people who are just bashing it without even giving it a chance. I feel sorry for them though as well. I feel bad for the filmmakers who are having to deal with this, and I feel bad for the people. I'm like, just try, go see it. I'm sure you'd like it. Like, I think that we've all agreed it was.
Well, what upsets me is if people really want to make this a religious argument, go see the movie. In that sense, and then give an actual opinion about it. Because right now, it's a lot of people like, oh, this should, you know.
No,
but,
I agree.
But it's persevering. I mean, the country Indonesia just today.
Malaysia
is banning it.
Yeah.
Countries in the Middle East, Malaysia, and also I think Indonesia, they've all kind of decided to prohibit the showing.
Let me, and Rob Moore, again, executive Paramount, he further goes on about the CinemaScore. Now, they have all the information. And again, we don't read about this, but he went on to say that 63% of the audience gave the PG-13 movie an A or a B, and 14% gave it a D or an F, which brings down the average. And he says that's the backlash that comes from the outliers who expected Noah to be strict biblical interpretation. So, you know, when you're having 63%.
And maybe all the parents who you saw who brought their kids who were like, we are not happy that they have now seen.
Well,
it could be that.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. But again, I'm going to say, and again, if I can bring it up, there was another article that said that the controversy, and it came from a church in a Sunday school, that actually said, you know, it provides basically the article for, and this is from Kansas City. It's a church controversy over Noah movie provides a teaching opportunity. And I'm like, you know, yeah, I'm glad that some church says, hey, it opens up discussion. And I was telling you earlier, there's a woman that I work with. Her name is Vanessa. She is very faith-based, sweet as can be, and she's a smart woman. And we all week have been talking about Noah, and I wanted to pick her mind because I knew that she's like, you know, she plays guitar for her church and she's in the choir and she holds prayer meetings. And, you know, I had such great conversation with her, and to talk to somebody who is as open-minded, and she didn't hate the movie. And in fact, she was giving me insights on Noah and talking about this, and you can have this great conversation. What she was happy the most about was that it would get people to read the Bible. It would get them to go and maybe read about Noah in the Bible, and it would inspire them to do that. And I'm like, well, that's a healthy attitude. And, you know, in here again, in Overland Park Church is using the controversy surrounding the movie Noah as an opportunity to talk about faith. So I like when you can turn, when a church is able to turn a negative into a positive, and they're not coming out and blasting the movie. They're saying, hey, see the movie. They're encouraged so that we can talk about it. And that's what we're doing here. And this is where I think filmmaking, good filmmaking, works. When you can continue to talk about it and have these different opinions, and so long as we're open-minded, the conversation can be insightful, and at the same time, it should be fun because we're talking about movies. Ultimately, that's what we're doing.
Well, so. I mean, you know, there's a thing though, you know, when movies can transcend just being a form of entertainment and really inspire, teach, propel, and affect people in a really big way. Marissa, I want to go to you, being raised Catholic. What did you think of the movie from a religious standpoint? Agree, disagree, just anything, whatever.
You know what? Overall, I didn't mind this movie because I went into this movie expecting the really Christian aspect and point of view to it, but lo and behold, you know, Darren Aronofsky is an atheist. So I was expecting all these religious, like, maybe, like, overly religious kind of aspects to the film, but then found out, you know, that it was very liberal and creative things here and there, but overall, I came into the movie with an open mind, and I think the way that they portrayed it, it really did get people thinking. And I mean, I went back to the Bible after this movie and reread Noah. And so just taking that and opening it up to people who might have had those closed-minded or one-track mind and how the Noah story should be, I think it did a good job portraying the different aspects to it. And being a Catholic, I didn't mind it.
Interesting. Yeah.
Sarah?
My religious perspective on that?
Well, I don't even know what your religion is.
Well, if it does make...
Go ahead.
I've been through different phases, I guess, of religion throughout my life. There was a point when I was in high school, I taught Sunday school to third graders. And so I was very much part of the people who learned the happy-go-lucky version of Noah and the Ark. I think that adding perspectives like this, that not everything is so cheerful and beautiful, is good. I think that it adds a layer of insight and realism, and I think that the movie does a good job of showing multiple perspectives and showing how things can be joined between, like, religion and science. And I think offering that up is good. I can see why people would be kind of... I can see where the anger comes from. I can see why people want to make this as in everything has to be so black or white.
Because I think they want it to be black, but, like, okay, you know, the whole point is, you know, yeah, Noah ultimately is a good person, and, you know, they've always said, you know, you have traces of Adam in you, and, you know, but ultimately, because of free will and all that, yeah, you can fall, and you know what, you got to keep yourself in check, because that's how easy it is to fall out of line.
Go to the dark side.
Yeah. And yeah, and speaking of fallen, I loved how they showed fallen angels, because they brought that into the Noah story, which, you know, isn't there. But even the purpose of the Watchers, because we know that the Watchers weren't part of the building of the Ark, but I thought that added nice, that was a nice divide to the story device to add to that. So I thought that was interesting. But even the whole, you know, aspect of the fallen angels that, yes, they were kind of condemned on Earth, but they redeemed themselves. Sure. And then, so even showing that even they were bad at one point, but they can turn and be good and be forgiven. And I thought that was another cool, different way of showing the creator's work in this movie.
And I like, for me, I like the different phases of Noah and, you know, to, you know, how he interpreted things. At first, Emma Watson's character was a blessing and, you know, and things like that. But then all of a sudden, you know, it meant that, okay, it's a sign of, okay, she's barren for a reason. She, you know, we're not supposed to take kids onto this journey because it, you know, it means our death. And so how you interpret things. And again, it's not an easy way of looking at things, because ultimately it's a mirror upon yourself. And when you can't handle that, that's when you get upset with the world.
And yourself.
Well, well, they don't. That's the point. They want to blame everyone but themselves. And so, you know what? But the point being, you know, if you look at it, the ultimate message is beautiful, and you're supposed to say, hey, you know what? I can be a good person. I just have to be really, really careful.
Yeah. And again, to believe in the faith in such a way, you know, religion shouldn't go out of its way to hurt people. It should be about compassion. It should be about love and helping and wanting to be there. And I think ultimately that's the choice that Noah has to make for himself. And again, you know, not to belabor it, but to me that was the surprising nature of this movie, in which it does. It shows all that can be right and all that can be wrong with religion when you break it down. But ultimately what it comes down to is redemption, love, compassion for one other's human being or man, or woman, and for animals. I guess fish didn't like really factor in, because like a flood,
they just
fish.
Swim.
Yeah, they're just swimming. Yeah, all fish.
They
are great,
mentioned
including the
fish swimming.
Yeah, I know. So. But and again, I really like. I, I'm reading this article and this pastor Tim Howie of this Grace Church, he's like, you know, he's like, hey, for us, it's very exciting to examine the scriptures. And again, this is what, like, you know, Sunday school should be like, hey, this is an opportunity to take a field trip. It's a PG-13 movie. Let's go.
That's we'll talk surprising, about
it.
Though.
You know, there were parts of it, again, with the kids. Yeah. I was like, wow, that's so.
Because, you know, in terms of the pacing, they just really do a good job, especially with the child. They just do an amazing job of stretching everything out. And, you know, not that to me, the battle was just so epic, and there wasn't a lot of blood and gore, but it just felt epic and not PG-13.
I felt like I was watching the ends in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, the ends, yeah. And it got intense. It went to a place that, again, that was a surprise for me. I did not think that this movie was going to be so intense, and you're right, it's... The editing and the pacing, it stretched it out to a point of there was suspense. And in my heart and in my head, I'm thinking, he's not going to, like, they're not going to go down that road, are they? But there was that spark that thought, geez, Aronofsky might just do that.
Yeah. But, yeah, they were all pushed to the limits, Ham, the son, you know, everybody. And then as soon as Noah, you know, you don't understand why he's got, like, the flaming hot embers, but then the boat just goes up in flames, because you know, right, they made eye contact, Emma Watson's character and him, and he just kind of walks away, and you're like, is he gonna let him off that easy? Right. Is it because he knows they're gonna die out there? But then he takes no chance.
There were a lot of moments where I questioned Noah's character, if he had the decision over people who was gonna live and who wasn't. And there was the moment where I thought really took a dark turn was when the girl that Ham was wanting to save and bring on the ark, and then she gets trampled by so many people. That was a very dark turn, because we saw Noah just up and deliberately left her, and then I'm like, okay, that was a really dark moment. And then leading up to the point where, well, he let one person die, is he going to let the babies die? So I thought that was a really dark turn.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say that, Marissa, too, because that was the beginning for me. That was like that turn of the character going down to the dark side, let's say. When he did that, you actually felt for, who was that, Ham?
Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, oh my God, like, why would he do that? Like, why, what, oh, wow, he's taking a turn. And then when he blows up the boat, you're like, all right. There was coming to a point in the movie where I was not liking, that was starting to really not like Noah. And, you know, and again, he makes the right choice at the end. So he has that redemption. And perhaps that was the whole idea. You know, he had to bring this guy down. And then in order for an audience for himself to be redeemed. Because, like I said, it was getting to a point where I was just not liking him. He was being a jerk. and I think his family was seeing that too. But, yeah, you know, his beliefs were out.
And that was the whole thing. Overshadowing, you know, everything else. The rain stopped because the baby, you know, it's a sign of goodness. No, the rain stopped because of the baby as a sign of bad.
You're right.
You know, and that was the whole debate, you know. And so, again, I just love that aspect of it. Any last thoughts before we wrap up tonight's dissection?
I think that overall, I think that my favorite aspect of Noah was just that I came out feeling like I had sat by and heard a wonderful story by a fire while simultaneously, like, I'm getting a little tired, in that scene where he does tell the story about creation, he has the cups, and, like, that's how I felt the whole story was being told to me. But then I got to see, like, the inside of, like, Darren's imagination. So that to me was just beautiful and such an art for the movie of Noah, that I felt on one half of me the story was layered but simple and directly told, and then I got to see just the beautiful imagery that he had created. And so I was very happy with it.
Yeah. What I appreciated about it, I think the most for me, was the fact that I didn't have a clear answer as to whether or not I liked it or disliked it when I got out of the movie. You know, it's a good movie to sit down. I had to really ingest it and digest it, think about it, And, you know, sometimes, you know, you can think about a movie and then you'll think about why it was really good or why it was really bad. This one left me with like, I remember walking to my car. It was a good movie to sit down, pour a couple of fingers of scotch, have a cigar, and just like think about the movie. I didn't have anybody, like I saw the movie by myself. And so I didn't have the immediate talk back to somebody, but I just had to like just sit and think about this movie and take the time to ingest it all and think about, you know, why is it getting this controversy? You know, because why didn't I think it was controversial? Like, did I miss something or what is my beliefs in this? And then at the end of it all say, you know, that was a really good movie. And then when I had conversations like right here makes me appreciate the movie more. When I had the conversations with like that woman, Vanessa, made me appreciate the movie more and for what it's, you know, and why I think like good filmmaking is very positive. And do you see these, like this was epic. It was nice. So, the last time there was a movie that was so talked about, to me anyways, with like, and I don't know if it'll have that longevity, but Man of Steel, people either loved it or hate it, and it caused a lot of people talking about movies. I like that aspect. Love or hate Noah, you can't not talk about it in a good educational
comic books way. Is a whole different religion.
That's true. We're not but gonna get see, into that it's today. A religion. See, but that's, yeah.
Marissa.
Overall, I did enjoy this movie. And coming from a religious aspect, I did enjoy it. I thought what was so well done with this movie was Aronofsky's vision. And I thought it was visually fantastic. Cinematography was amazing. And I'm a visual learner. That's how I absorb stories and anything like that. And I thought the whole spectacle, it felt like an epic movie. And it is, because it is an epic story. It's an apocalypse. We kind of want it, we go to movies to see that because we don't want to see it in real life. We see it in movies. But so I saw the visual epicness of this movie, and I thought even the arc itself, that was a character in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And I felt the humongous size and like the overall story of it. And even Emma Watson said in an interview that they built that arc to size. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm like, wow, that's amazing.
You can
amazing.
Actually see more about it if you go to, I believe it's noahthemovie.com or something. If you look up Noah's website, they have a whole interactive arc adventure where you can kind of see their built to skies.
I want to know how many followers Noah has gotten since the movie has come out.
Yeah. So, and I liked how they showed the raw, gritty aspect of humans, but then they showed us the beautiful aspects of the world and just those two colliding together. I thought it was really well done.
And hey, you. That's right, you. Because you know what? No longer is there just an audience. We're going to have a one-to-one relationship with our fan. So you, fan listening or watching right now, speaking of the arc, you know, we didn't go into production design as much, so you're wondering or thinking like, oh, you guys didn't talk about the movie in its entirety. I understand that. It's always going to be difficult. How do you transition from one to the other, et cetera? And, you know,
we didn't
how do
talk
you
about the awful costuming of the giant swab of hair going down Turbo King's arm.
So you're, these are all things that you're angry and upset about us for not discussing, but hey, you know what?
That water was really cold.
It was. But you get to rate, you get to comment, and we collectively here will respond, we'll read up on it. We loved dissecting movies, and ultimately, as long as we dissect them, it doesn't mean it ends.
No.
The discussion does not end. Our participation does not end. The end of the show does not mean the end of the discussion of Noah.
Never.
So that means you!
We hope to perpetuate the discussion. Yeah. We want you to take it out. Bring your friends along for the ride.
Exactly. Too. And don't look over at the guy next to you. I'm talking to you! So, hey, rate, comment, let us know what you thought of the movie, what you loved about it, what you didn't like about it, any things that, you know, you want to discuss more of. And we've got a whole slew of movies coming up. You know, we'll be here till at least 2050. So,
great.
So until the next dissection, this is Dimitri Panos, Sarah Strand, Marissa Serafini, and Phil Svitek signing off. Until the next dissection, which will be Bad Words.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.